You're listening to The Phil Nason Show, presented by Swag, Screen and Textile.
Drive! Deep to left field! Out of here! Oh,
man. Swung on! Hit high! Hit deep to right! This ball!
There's a breaking ball in for a strike, and he stood there like the house by the side of the road and watched it go by. Struck him out.
A deep drive to right center. They won't need the pitch run for it here.
Right-hander against the right-hander. The outfield is straight up and deep on Fielder. He is the DH today. Swing, there's a drive to left. That one is long gone.
Welcome to the Phil Nason Show.
Good evening and welcome to the Phil Nason Show. I have a great show planned for you tonight. First up is Miss Tanya Mercado from CityFieldOfDreams.com and the Five Tools Show, and we'll be talking Mets baseball. Followed by the author of The Last Icon, Tom Seaver and His Times, Mr. Stephen Travers. And to close the night show, my friend and Colorado Rockies fan, Mr. Ruben Mills, is here to hash out this last weekend's Mets-Rockies series. And it all starts after the music. You're listening to The Phil Nason Show.
Meet the Mets. Step right up and greet the Mets. Bring your kiddies, bring your wife. Guaranteed to have the time of your life, because the Mets are really socking the ball, knocking those home runs over the wall. East side, west side, everybody's coming down to meet the M-E-T-S Mets of New in their seats. Where do they go? To meet the Mets! All the fans are true to the orange and blue, so hurry up and come on down, 'cause we got ourselves a ball club, the Mets of New York town. Give them a yell! Give them a hand! And let them know you're rooting in the stand. Come on and meet the Mets! Meet the Mets! Right up and greet the Mets. Bring your kiddies, bring your wife. Guaranteed to have the time of your life, because the Mets are really stopping the ball, knocking those home runs over the wall. East side, west side, everybody's coming down to meet the M-E-T-S Mets of New
Okay, my first guest, Miss Tanya Mercado, needs no introduction to you regular listeners of The Phil Nason Show, but for the sake of those of you listening for the first time, she is the owner of the popular New York Mets fan blog, City Field of Dreams, as well as the co-host of Blog Talk Radio program, The Five Tools Show, as well as the Blog Talk Radio program, Raise Your Glass. Please welcome Tanya Mercado to The Phil Nason Show. Tanya, how are you doing this evening?
I'm good, Phil. How are you?
I'm doing great. It's like we just spoke, right?
It really does feel that way, doesn't it?
It does. Yeah, I had a great time last night on your program. You guys do a great job over there.
Well, thank you. You were a lot of fun. I love having you as a guest on our program because you're always a lot of fun. Because you always come up like with all these interesting things.
It's because that second cup of coffee kicks in and I get a little squirrely, I guess. But it's fun. But and plus, you know, the thing is you and Carell are on this program every 2 or 3 weeks. So it's really fun to just chat baseball with you guys.
This is true.
You know, and a lot of times I have to come up with something different because it'll just all become redundant and no one will listen. And who wants that?
Yeah, that's never a good thing.
Never.
So I don't envy you.
No, it's all good because we have plenty we can talk about tonight. But the first thing that I want to talk about and let you promote a little bit is your Raise Your Glass program. You know, I listened to it the other night, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. How did that all come about? How did you get started with that, Tanya?
Well, first of all, thank you for listening to it. I've been through a lot in my life. I was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress syndrome, among other things. And one day I had kept thinking that there had to be a reason why I've been through so much. And I just kept thinking, all this stuff that happened to me could not have been just for nothing. It couldn't have been just to make me stronger. So I wrote an email to my boss at NDB Media, who he owns the Five Tools show as well. And I pitched the show that I wanted to do to him. And since he was so happy with the Five Tools show, he gave me the green light to go ahead with it after he talked it over with the rest of the people on the board. And so I made the decision I would base the show on what I had been through in my life. And I kept thinking I was kept alive for a reason. So I felt the need to help others with what I had been through in hopes that it would encourage people to continue living despite their current situations or maybe their past situations. And so far it has been a huge success, and I hope it continues to grow. I've had quite a few comments about it, and I'm enjoying it more and more. And you know, in all honesty, if I could turn this show into something bigger, I would do it. My goal is to help as many people as I can. Because sometimes people just need someone to talk to, and a lot of times it does help when that person is just a stranger rather than somebody who knows them, knows their situation, knows the people that is involved in the other person's situations. So I've really enjoyed it, and it's also been kind of therapeutic for me as well.
Yeah, it's really good. How did you come up with the title, Raise Your Glass? Is that from the Pink song, or is it just something that you've experienced in your life? Or
a little bit of both. I remember listening to the song by Pink, and I was like, wow, this song is really amazing. And I just kept thinking about it and thinking about it. And when I was trying to think of a title for the show, I kept thinking about there's a song that Josh Groban sings, and it's called You Raise Me Up. And I was thinking about that for a title. But then I was like, no, I want something a little bit more fun, something that, you know, more people can relate to. And I know everybody's heard that song by Pink. So I'm thinking, you know what, that would be great. I don't drink. I know a lot of people out there do drink. I personally, every time I do the show, I always have like a cup of tea in front of me, and I'm drinking tea. So I always encourage people that when they're listening to the show, you know, just grab a glass, whether it's wine, which is their preference, or tea, which is mine. You know, and then together we'll just like raise our glass to whatever the topic is.
That's pretty catchy. Now, you mentioned NBD Media. Now, what is that? Because they're probably not thrilled with me from last night's show. But what is NBD Media all about?
NBD Media is a new media company. It's just getting off the ground. It was founded by Roger Noriega, who is based out in California. It's run by him, Peter Gamma, and Cliff Zier. I don't know if I'm mispronouncing his last name. But they all work on this. And they have different programming, from sports to television to politics to traveling, like a travel show. And then they have, like, my program, which is just on everyday life. And they had heard my, they read my blogs, and they had asked me to help them, you know, with doing a show, which was the Five Tools show. And then from there, I got Raise Your Glass. And there are a lot of sports shows that they do. So they're just trying to, like, get it off the ground and really, really try to get, like, a following. And they've had quite a few listeners, because I've listened to quite a few of their programs, ranging from sports to television. And I have to say, I love the television shows that they do and the comic book shows. The comic book shows are amazing. Like last night they did one on Marvel Comics and the Avengers movie, which was a really good program. But yeah, I'm happy with the way that the company's growing, and I'm hoping that it continues to grow.
Well, yeah, if they continue to keep you on their programs, it will, because people listen. I found that out last night. When I was trying to close down my computer, I have all these Facebook requests, and all these different things. It was really cool. I'll tell you what, we wish you luck with that Raise Your Glass program. It's not easy to be as vulnerable as you are on that show. It takes a lot of courage to do. It takes a lot of courage, you know.
It does. I mean, and that's one of the things that I've always, I kind of take comfort in that, because if me being vulnerable and just sharing my experiences will help somebody else, then it's completely worth it. Because people will be like, oh, wow, you know, she's out there and she's just saying everything that's happened to her. I can relate to that. She got through it. Maybe I can get through it. And that's basically what the show is all about for me.
And that's great. Okay, we're going to move on now, Tanya, to a little Mets baseball. Last night when we were doing your show, you mentioned that it's always the bullpen. What would you like to see improved if, let's say, pretend you're the general manager tonight. What would you like to see improved, and how would you go about doing that?
I would like to see a bullpen that just comes in and shuts down the opposing team 1, 2, 3. Nice and simple. But with the Mets, it never happens. We've had our heart attacks with John Franco, Armando Benitez, Francisco Rodriguez, the temporary failed experiment with Bobby Parnell. You know, granted, no bullpen is perfect. I mean, the only perfect member I have ever witnessed is Mariano Rivera. And I don't expect another Rivera, but I would like something close to it. And I think one of the problems the bullpen has dealt with is being overworked because the starters don't go deep enough in a game. You know, this whole thing where pitchers are on a pitch count, it kind of drives me crazy. Because once the pitcher reaches that count, you cut them off and then you bring in the bullpen. So if the pitcher's struggling and he's made it to like 80 pitches and it's only the third inning, what happens? They bring in somebody from the bullpen and there you go. These guys get overworked, they get tired, and then you're screwed for the next 2-3 games. Because you're going to constantly be using these guys. Because the Mets, honestly, their pitchers don't go deep into games. Mike Pelfrey was pretty much the only pitcher who ate innings. You know, whether he was bad or good, you knew he was going to go out there and just pitch till his arm fell off. You know, I think the only other pitcher is R.A. Dickey who can pitch deep into a game. Outside of that, nobody else on this staff can. You know, so I think some of the problem does start with the rotation going deeper and the offense as well. The offense needs to actually step their game up and actually start hitting so that when the bullpen comes in, it's not so much pressure on the bullpen. But I think that's another factor also, all the pressure that's being put on them. I would honestly like to see the bullpen just come in and just shut these guys down. They started off really well. But for whatever reason, lately, they're kind of like falling apart a little bit. And Manny Acosta is one of them and needs to go.
Okay. There's people out there who think that Terry Collins is too quick with the hook. What do you think about that? Do you think he takes them out too soon? Them being the starters, of course.
Sometimes I do think that. I do think that. I think if it's a game that you know you're probably going to lose because chances are your offense is not going to step up, then I think you just leave the guy in there. Just be like, you know what? Leave him in. Just whatever. Because you can't have your bullpen overworked. You know, a bullpen is important. I think starters need to at least get to the seventh inning. If you can get the seventh inning and then just use your pitcher for maybe from the seventh to the ninth, I think that would be much better on the bullpen. Because sometimes you get into situations where you have your specialist, you bring in your specialist for one hitter, and then what? You know, say you use the guy, you know, two nights in a row, and then you're going to bring him in for a third night to pitch an entire inning. He probably feels like his arm's going to fall off. You know, who knows how he's feeling? And then you just bring in the specialist for one pitcher, and then you bring in this guy. It's just too much wear and tear on the bullpen. And we've seen it way too many times. And I know a lot of people killed Joe Girardi for it. Because Girardi did this all the time where he would overwork the bullpen. You know, and I think Collins just needs to let his starters go out there and just pitch. Let them get their innings in.
Okay, and then you mentioned Manny Acosta. Now, what about him? He's had some struggles this last, say, week. But last year...
Some struggles?
Yeah, he's had a few. He had a little bit of one tonight, too, in fact. But last year toward the end, he was probably one of the more consistent people out of the bullpen. Now, you say he needs to go, and that's fair enough. Now, who would you replace him with? Because, quite frankly, it's not easy to find relief pitchers. Who would you replace him with in the Mets organization, or would you look elsewhere?
The Mets rarely ever have pitchers. I don't know what it is with this franchise and not having pitching depth in their minors. They don't have it. You know, I mean, look at Chris Schwinden. He was supposed to be a guy that was going to come up and be able to get the job done. And his last two starts, today and in Colorado, was awful. Okay? So I really don't think that there really is anybody that the Mets can turn to. They would probably have to go elsewhere. And who they would get, I really don't know. Because in all honesty, I really feel this way, for whatever reason, pitchers that are supposed to be good, they come to Citi Field to die. They really do. For whatever reason, they cannot seem to get the job done. I don't know if it's Citi Field. Maybe it's just, I don't know, the whole negative feeling around Citi Field. But for whatever reason, we can't get a decent relief pitcher. I don't know why. So I really wouldn't know who they can actually go out and get without having to give up something that might be valuable to them. Because both, you know, relievers for any franchise is hard to get. Relievers altogether. So I'm not really sure who they would be able to get, because teams who are in the running are going to be looking for relievers. They're going to be looking for pitching, because pitching is always, always something that teams go after.
Yeah, maybe what they could do is convert one of these guys in the minors, one of our better prospects, and convert them into either a closer or put them in a situation where they're in mid to long relief. What about, say, doing that with a kid like Familia, or maybe Mejia if he comes back, or maybe a Harvey?
No. If you're going to train these guys to be starters, then you keep developing them as a starter. I am so sick and tired of this organization trying to change a player. You know, it happened with Daniel Murphy, and they screwed Daniel Murphy up completely. If you're going to develop a player to be a certain type of player, you keep developing them that way. Do not screw with them saying, oh, you know what, we're going to develop you and you're going to be a reliever. And then maybe a year later, you're like, oh, you know what, we decide we're going to make you a starter. Don't do that. There's a reason why they're in the minors. They are in the minors to develop into a certain role, and you keep developing them into that role. The Mets do not have a decent amount of starters that can come up and play in the majors. So the guys that they do have, they need to keep developing them in that role, because the Mets are going to need them. So I would not want to see a Harvey or a Familia being converted from a starter to a reliever. Mejia, he was on the Mets, and he was a reliever, and he did good in that position. So you know what? Maybe you could have Mejia as a reliever. But I would not touch Harvey. I would not touch Wheeler. I would not touch Familia. You keep them in the roles that they are in, and you keep developing them in that role. I think it does more damage than good.
That's fair enough. But the thing is, for me, you know, they got to get them in there sometime. And with our starting staff now, when do you think? How do you determine when someone's ready? How would you do it?
September call-ups. September call-ups.
That's a perfect answer. I was thinking that earlier today too. But with, like, say, Harvey, you know, when you look at these guys in spring training, it's very unfair to judge someone in spring training. You know, you go, is he ever going to be ready? You know, we've been hearing about some of these guys for years. I mean, when is it time to bring them up? And you say September call-ups. But if this season goes south, and this week so far, Houston series, is starting to lead me to believe it's going to be a very long year, would you consider bringing them up sooner and giving them an opportunity? And what do you do with these other starters like Nice and Dickey? Well, Dickey, you keep in the rotation. What about Johan Santana? You know, if you've got Nice, Santana, and Dickey, you don't have a whole lot of room, do you? And Dylan G, too. What do you do with these prospects? Do you leave them in AAA forever?
No. Wheeler still needs work. Harvey still needs work. You know, at the earliest, maybe they'll come up maybe next year or the following year. But you don't rush these guys. At some point, you bring them up in September, see what they could do in September, and then you make the decision then. You know, but at some point, you bring them up in September, you just throw them out there. Be like, let's see what you got. You know, Santana's not going to be on the Mets forever. You know, Mike Pelfrey, he's probably done. So that's two spots right there, Wheeler and Harvey. You know, and there's been a lot of talk surrounding Wheeler and Harvey that these guys are going to be amazing when they come up. You know, but you have to let them develop. You have to make sure that they have their pitches, that they can locate their pitches, they have the control, and then you bring them up in September, throw them out there. If they get hit, let them get hit. Let them take their licks. Because you're right. At what point can you say, okay, they're ready? There really is no point. You know, you could see what they do in the minors. They could be phenomenal in the minors, come up to the majors, and they suck. But you have to just be like, take your licks. Oh, you know what? You're getting knocked around? It's fine. Just keep going. Because they have to learn. They have to face major league pitching at some point, and September is the month to do it in.
Yeah, that makes sense. And you mentioned Mike Pelfrey. How much are the Mets, and we talked about this a little bit last night, but I guess more importantly, a better question would be, do you think we've seen the last of Mike Pelfrey in a Mets uniform?
I hate answering this question. I get asked this question all the time, and I hate this question. Like, as I mentioned last night on the Five Tool Show, I have always been a Mike Pelfrey fan. Since he was in the minors, since he was drafted, I have been following Mike Pelfrey's career. I have always believed in him. I've believed in his talent. And I hate to say this, but I think it is possible that we have seen the last of Mike Pelfrey as a New York Met. I think once the surgery, you know, he has his surgery, that's it. We saw the last, and it's a shame because he was doing well. We started seeing the Mike Pelfrey of 2010, and that encouraged me. I was one of the first ones at the end of last year saying, this guy needs to go. I don't want to see him anymore. And this is coming from somebody who supported him from day one. But to see that he was actually putting in the work and that he was working on his mechanics and it was helping him, it kind of encouraged me. I know some people are like, oh, well, it's a long season. Yeah, it's a long season. But you know what? If you're learning a new pitch or you're trying to fine-tune something so you can get better, you have to give them some slack. You have to be like, okay, you know what? You're working at it. And if you're working at it, fine. You know, maybe he needed to go down to the minors and work on it. You know, that was always an option. They did it with Steve Traxel. Steve Traxel was awful. And then they sent him down to the minors. He came up and he was amazing. He was not that bad anymore. You know, but I think it's safe to say that, yes, we have seen the last of Mike Pelfrey on this team. And I guarantee you he'll go to another team and he'll kill the Mets.
You know what? That might be right. Because he had the Tommy John surgery on Tuesday, I believe.
Yes.
And technically, what they say is that technically he can be back in a year. So to tender Pelfrey a contract would be pretty silly, I think. So I do think that we've seen the last of Mike Palfrey. I personally didn't like him at all in the last couple of years. But it's interesting enough that two of the games that I was able to see like live or through the stream that were decent were both games that he pitched. And both times, I was like impressed. And especially this last time, and I had Corral Cooper on this show the next night, and I said, why did they not bring him in the ninth inning? Well, now we know, because he tore his UCL. So that's a shame, though, and I don't want to wish this guy any bad luck, because he's one of those homegrown players that is very rare to have. And one of the things that I noticed in the Marlins series that last night, all nine position players or nine starters were homegrown talent, meaning no, they've never played for any other team but the New York Mets. What does that say about our minor league system, Tanya?
I think that says that we have a better minor league system than people give this organization credit for. And the fact that some of these players have actually been from the Minaya regime, I think that says a lot also, because for all the killing that people did with Omar Minaya, they should give him credit now, because some of these players are guys that he drafted and brought in. So I think Mets fans should be excited the fact that these guys are homegrown, you know, and we have a chance of having a team for a few years that will be guys that we can actually say, you know what? They were nurtured through our organization, and look at how great they are. You know, for all the ripping that people do with the Mets minor leagues, oh, they're not that good. Really? Well, look at how many of our guys are in the majors right now, and they're doing well. They don't, you know, they don't suck. They come in, they play hard. They leave it all on the field. You know, a lot of these guys come in with no fear. They go out there, all guns blazing, come what may, bring it. And that's the attitude. And I like that attitude, and I like to see that they're coming up through the minors with that attitude. And I hope it stays that way, and they don't get comfortable and start slacking.
Yeah, that's always a danger, the slacking, being comfortable, slacking, and what have you. You know, you've been very positive this year, or you've tried to be, or tried to remain positive about the Mets. really, you have. I compliment you for that, because it's not always easy, is it?
No, it's really not. It's really, really not. Especially with the Mets fan base, it's not easy to be positive.
You're right. But what discourages you most about being a Mets fan?
Isn't being a Mets fan discouraging enough?
Yeah, you're right. But what is it about that?
Well, I mean, it depends. If you're talking overall or just this year. If you're talking overall, I would say that we only have two championships when we should have had more. You know, the 2000 World Series should have belonged to the Mets. But Benitez blew that up for us. I think the team should have made it to the World Series in 2006 and the playoffs in 2007 and 2008. I feel like this organization, for whatever reason, they just can't seem to get over that hump that takes them all the way or takes them to that next level. Now, if you're just talking this year, I can honestly say I'm not really all that discouraged. You know, nobody really, and I'm being completely honest here, nobody gave this team a shot in hell to go anywhere. Everybody's like, this team's finishing in last place. You know, even Mets fans were convinced it was a rebuilding year. You know, they went into this year expecting nothing. And look at the team right now. Did you think that the Marlins and Phillies would be underneath the New York Mets? Because I sure as hell didn't. You know, despite what they said about the Phillies getting older, you know, look at the talent that the Marlins have. And for them to be under the New York Mets, I mean, yeah, we were only in the second month, but it's still a step in the right direction. So I'm actually pleasantly surprised with this team. I'm not all that discouraged.
Yeah, me too. I'm surprised, honestly. This week, though, is kind of demonstrating for me what my greatest fear was, is that they would just not compete. And when you play a team like the Astros, don't you have to go in there and at least win that series? Because they played really well in Colorado, except for the first game. And they swept the Marlins, and they swept the Braves this year. I mean, what do you think, what happened with the Astros? Do you think that they maybe took this team, this Houston team, a little too lightly?
No. I just think that it's the case that the Mets never do well against teams that they should beat. They do better against teams that they should not beat. For whatever reason, I don't know. It's kind of like the story of my life. But they can't do well against teams that are bad. Teams that are bad always seem to beat up on the Mets. So I don't think that the Mets went in feeling like, okay, you know what, we're going in and we're going to easily dominate the Astros. I don't think that was the case at all. I think it was just bad pitching on the part of the Mets. You know, there was just way too many walks, way too many long balls, and that's what hurt this team the most. The pitching just was not there at all. And I think that was the turning point of this series. That's what did them in.
Yeah, that's what happened. And plus, the boys didn't hit after the first night. I mean, they really didn't. It's amazing to me, and not having Lucas Duda in the lineup changes things dramatically. And that came as a kind of a good surprise for me. It just goes to show he's putting fear into people, because that's one guy whoever's in front or behind him, you know, they can't just pitch around folks. You know what I mean? I'll tell you who's really impressed me this year so far is Ruben Tejada. And who's impressed you the most so far? What Met has impressed you so much that you went, wow?
Nieuwenhuis.
All right. Yeah, I should have known.
Captain Kirk. I love him. I think he is the most amazing player. He is a hard-nosed, no-nonsense, all guns blazing Clint Eastwood type of player.
Okay, tell us how you really feel.
I mean, he doesn't care who he goes up against. He'll go to the plate and he'll be like, give me your best shot. Bring it. I will take you out. I don't care what it'll take. I'm going to take you out one way or the other. You know, and then the catches that he makes in center field. Some of those catches, I have to say, give me heart palpitations, because I'm like, oh my gosh, he's going to kill himself. He's going to get hurt. The way he hits the ground and makes these diving plays is just, it leaves me speechless. And I can honestly say I just stare at the TV with my mouth hanging open thinking, did he really just make that play? You know, and he's been the biggest surprise, and I'm enjoying watching him play. There are a few players that I can actually say I go out and I actually enjoy watching them play. He's one of them that I'll go out there and I'm like, I could watch him play all day.
Yeah, I tell you what,
he's just amazing.
That catch he made in the left center field gap, I have it on my blog. It was all over that video went viral. Geez, he really flies out there. I enjoy watching him play as well. Who has not impressed you very much this year?
Do you mean other than Jason Bay? I would probably say Ike Davis. And I understand the whole thing with the Valley Fever and everything. But he was just one of those guys that you were really, really stoked to see coming into the season. You were like, oh my gosh, we got David Wright. We got Ike Davis. Then you hear what Duda was doing down in spring training. That's it. It's on. And then Ike Davis comes in, Valley Fever. Oh my God. Somebody just shot my monkey. That was it. And I'm hoping that this is just a spell and Ike Davis will be the Ike Davis that we all think he should be and he can be. But for right now, yeah. Ike Davis has been like one of the biggest disappointments this year.
How long do you think Terry Collins is going to stay with him, though? I mean, Terry Collins is quick with his pitchers. Is he going to be quick with Ike Davis, you think? And he's so far he's been long-suffering, I would say. Because it, when you watch Ike Davis hit, it's either he jacks it or he strikes out. How long do you think Terry Collins should stay with him?
I think, I honestly, by mid-May, if he's not really doing anything, then you have to start thinking about what you're going to do, who you're going to put there. Because at that point, he's not helping the team. And if you really, if this team is really in a position where they can compete, you can't have Ike Davis still on this team. And it's, and this is coming from somebody who loves Ike Davis. You know, he's another one of those players that I've been following since he was in the minors. And I would love to see him stay. But if he's going to do more harm than good, you have to say, okay, you know what, enough's enough. We need that middle of the lineup to be strong, and Ike Davis is just not getting it done. So I would think that I wouldn't be surprised if Terry Collins right now is starting to think about it. You know, because the Mets are within striking distance, you know, despite the Astros series. You know, they still have a shot. I mean, it's only the first week of May. There's no reason for people to start panicking. Oh, my God, the season's over. It's not. You know, there's just some key things, you know, some little areas here and there that need to get tweaked. And I think Alderson will get the job done because even Alderson said, you know what, if we're in the race, we're going to go and get what needs to be done. You know, and if one of those things is to pull like Davis, then you pull like Davis and you find somebody else for first base.
Who would you put at first base?
I hate that question, too.
Who's on first?
That's probably one of my favorite skits.
Oh, mine too.
I honestly don't know. You know, some people would be like, okay, well, you know what, put Daniel Murphy. Okay, you're messing with Daniel Murphy's head. Either he's at second base or he's at first base. Stop throwing him in different positions. Put him in one spot, leave him there, let him learn. But then you have to think, well, then who's going to fill first base? Some people have toyed with the idea of moving David Wright to first base because they feel that he's not good defensively at third base, being able to throw all the way to first. I wouldn't do that. I would keep David Wright at third, and maybe, I don't even know who I would put at first, to be honest.
Okay.
I never really thought about it.
All right. I have, because I have this sneaking suspicion that Ike Davis is going to be traded. That's what I think.
Don't say that.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Don't. I will boycott.
No, you know, it'll be all right, because here's what I think will wind up happening. They'll move Lucas Duda to first base because that's actually where he's more comfortable. They'll more than likely, because when Jason Bay comes back, what are you going to do with him? They'll probably place Bay out and left again and move Neuenheis out to right. Neuenheis has proven that he can play in the major leagues so far. And if they have to trade somebody, that's the way they go. The other way to probably do it would be to move Daniel Murphy, because I don't honestly see Daniel Murphy as the future New York Mets second baseman. I think he's just filling a spot right now because they need his bat in the lineup. So moving him over might be another thing. I'd hate to see Ike Davis go because I like him too. But they have to do something with someone. Otherwise, they're not going to get anyone. Because they don't spend money, because they don't have it. So they have to get rid of an asset or two. And I'm afraid it might be Ike Davis, Tanya.
No. I think, in all honesty, Mets fans will have a conniption if they were to trade Ike Davis. Because he's a fan favorite. Mets fans love him, especially after all those catches that he made. Going over the rail, you can't trade Ike Davis. I mean, this is what I'm talking about. You can't keep trading your homegrown players. You know, you have to just leave them there. Let them learn. Let them do what they need to do. Why do you have to trade Ike Davis?
Well, in order to get maybe that relief pitcher we need. That's why.
I can't part ways with Ike Davis.
I understand what you mean. But I remember a long time ago, I didn't think they would ever trade Tom Seaver, and they did. So, and Tom Seaver was a bigger part of, bigger to the club than Ike Davis. I think something has to be done, because if the Mets re-sign David Wright, and by all means, I think they should. I honestly think they should. Something has to give. And Ike Davis, he's got a ceiling above him that's huge. You can go 1-for-1 with him. Maybe even 2-for-1. So you never know. That's basically what I would do. But I'm in agreement with you about the disappointment. But I think Davis is just, we have to remember something about Davis is that last year he only had 125 at-bats before he left after that freak injury. So he's trying to find his groove. And like you said, this Valley Fever thing. You know, I've had mono, and mono really sucks. And they say Valley Fever is worse. So
mm-hmm. I've had mono, too.
Oh, it's horrible. It's great if you like chocolate shakes. But, but not much. It's not much good for anything else. Now, this Valley Fever thing, though, they say that could take like a year, or maybe he'll never be right. Have you heard that?
I have heard that, and I do believe it, because I know when I had mono, the doctors had told my parents that I would probably never fully recover from it. I'll always have, you know, something going wrong. Because I know when I had mono, it got so bad to the point where my organs had started to shut down. So, and if Valley Fever is worse than that, God help Ike Davis. I mean, in all seriousness. There was a player, I forgot his name right now. And he had Valley Fever last year, and it ended his entire year. And I don't know if it was last year or a few years ago, and he's never been the same. His numbers went down and never came back the same again.
Didn't he play for Phoenix or Arizona? I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I can't remember.
He played for the Diamondbacks.
Yeah, I can't remember.
I think it was Connor.
That's probably it.
His last name was Connor.
Maybe so. Yeah, that might be it. But yeah, we hope that isn't the issue for many reasons. For many reasons. I'll tell you what, Tanya, it's always great having you here at the Phil Nason Show. I appreciate you taking the time. I know how busy you are this week or two, and I do appreciate having you on the program.
Well, thank you. It's always a pleasure being on the show with you. I love being on your show. Your show's probably one of my favorite ones that I actually listen to on a regular basis.
All right, that's good, because Mark Berman, I'm making Mark become a fan of yours too. He doesn't listen to mine or ours when he's on. I guess he can't handle the sound of his own voice. But you know, he used to be a radio guy, so he's a tough act to follow. But you do a good job with that. All right. So now, folks, if you want to catch Tanya Mercado, you can go to cityfieldofdreams.com, or you can go to the Five Tools Show or Raise Your Glass. I'll have links to all those sites of hers in the show notes, and we want to wish her the best on her shows. We'll have her back on in a couple weeks, and we want to wish her the best as she's preparing to graduate from college. It's a big thing, my friend. Congratulations.
Thank you.
All right. Well, this has been a great beginning, but we're not stopping just yet. Coming up next, Mr. Stephen Travers is here to tell us all about his latest book, The Last Icon, Tom Seaver and His Times. You're listening to the Phil Nason Show. All right, we're back. And my next guest is an ex-professional baseball player who has written over 19 books. Here tonight to talk about his latest book, The Last Icon, Tom Seaver and His Times, is Mr. Stephen Travers. Stephen, welcome to the Phil Nason Show.
Well, thank you very much, Phil. I appreciate it very much.
You have no idea how long I've been looking forward to this. It took me a long time just to email you, because I can be kind of shy at times, but I'm so happy that you're here. Could you do us a favor and introduce yourself a little bit, tell us a little bit about yourself so that the listener can get to know you a little better?
Well, I'm born and raised in California, as was Tom Seaver, and this was the original thing that attracted me to Seaver, because I was right from the very beginning, a huge fan of the USC Trojans. And that was the very first thing about Tom Seaver that that attracted me to him. I went on to a fairly successful, you know, high school, college, and few years of professional baseball career, and patterned my pitching motion after Tom Seaver. I saw the way he pitched, and I read an interview that he did in a really wonderful book that Walt Alston wrote about a handbook on baseball. And Seaver detailed how he did it, and I learned that at a young age, at around 12 or 13, and pitched like him, or tried to. And played a few years of professional ball, and went on to get married and do some other things. But eventually got into writing, wrote screenplays, and then wrote for the LA Times and the San Francisco Examiner and a magazine, and eventually settled into writing books, which is what I'm doing right now.
Yeah, and this book that you've written about Tom Seaver, The Last Icon, is fantastic. Why did you decide to write this book? What was it about? And I understand the USC connection and growing up watching him pitch and whatever, but why did you finally decide, or what made you finally decide to write this book?
Well, I think the better question is why it took me so long, because this was always the book. This was always my number one subject. Along with USC football. Now, I've written a lot of books on USC football, and a lot of that came because I was asked to, and they had a period where they were very dominant, and I had several publishers who wanted me to address that. So that happened. But in terms of baseball, I've written a lot of baseball books, and it's really somewhat surprising that it took this long. I'd previously written a book about the 1969 New York Mets, and so a lot of the research that went into this book went into that one, or had already been done. He was just a figure that I knew so much about and admired greatly that it was just fate that I would write a book about him.
And how did you come up with the title, The Last Icon? Because it's a fitting title, by the way.
Well, because I felt that Seaver pitched during a period of what might be called the last age of innocence. After the 1969 season, the Vietnam War took over and finished badly. Watergate occurred, and then free agency hit in sports. And I felt that so much changed in America and in New York City, and the way sports fans view their heroes, that even though a Reggie Jackson or a Derek Jeter or an Alex Rodriguez, just to name three great New York athletes, might be, you know, technically as great as Seaver, I don't think engendered the kind of fan adoration that Seaver did. So in that respect, I believed he was the last icon.
Yeah, like I said, that was a fitting title. Now, Tom Seaver's kind of known for his privacy, and some people say that he's all about the money. What was Tom Seaver's involvement in this book, if there was any?
Well, I had previously dealt with him in the past, and his agent is someone who likes me a lot and has urged me for a long time to do a book on Seaver. You talk about Tom wanting, interested in the money. That really is what it came down to, is that the proposed deals from other publishers were not to his liking. So I ended up writing an unauthorized biography, which was a little bit disappointing, because I really don't feel that Seaver's ever written the book about his life that he should have, and maybe he will someday. But unfortunately, it came down to money. There were offers from publishers, and those offers were rejected as not enough by Tom Seaver. Oddly enough, while he is a guy who's interested in money, he's definitely a capitalist. My research indicated that he's one of the most underpaid sports superstars of all time for various reasons, mainly because a bad timing that he'd signed contracts just before the real free agent era hit. And then maybe his greatest years occurred before the real, real big money was there. So in that respect, Seaver was underpaid.
Yeah, I remember him stating that he was going to be the first pitcher to ever make $200,000 in a year. And now that just seems like peanuts. You have minor leaguers making that. We're here with Stephen Travers talking about his latest book, The Last Icon, Tom Seaver and His Times. Has Tom Seaver read this book, do you know, or has he made any comments about it?
Yeah, he's. I got a call from his agent who said that it was well received, and so I felt really good about that. It's a book that was well received, and apparently, hit the nail on the head, and really told his story the way it was supposed to be told.
Yeah, it certainly did. I'm glad that he read it. It's too bad that he wasn't a part of the book, because you would think there's not that many books written by others about Tom Seaver, are there?
Incredibly, there really aren't. That was the thing that really blew me away, is that the quintessential Seaver book had not been written. And oddly enough, here is one of the most erudite and articulate athletes of all time who has written many books. He wrote a novel. He's written, or at least has lent his name to, a lot of books that could be called scouting handbooks, or various books on how to pitch to other hitters. How to Pitch to Babe Ruth was the title of one of his books. He had written a book with Dick Schaap after his third year in the big leagues. There were a couple of books written about him. I think one even with his cooperation as early as 1978. And yet, here's a guy who retires in 1987, and in all the years since has not sat down and penned his memoirs. And it's not like he was out of the public eye. He was an announcer for the Mets and the Yankees for a number of years. He was an announcer for NBC. So he was in the limelight. And as I say, he's a well-read person who, it would seem that that would have been the thing he would do. But it's almost like, well, you know, he was in New York. He did it all. He achieved everything that could be achieved, and didn't feel that there was any need to do it beyond that.
I guess not, and it's too bad. You know, one of the things that you covered pretty well, and something that I had learned, was the odd way he wound up a New York Met. Can you kind of give us a brief overview of how that happened?
Yeah, well, it was very odd how he became a New York Met and not a Los Angeles Dodger. And having grown up in California and pitching at USC, and actually he had an uncle who had season tickets to Dodger games, and he went apparently to most of the games at Sandy Koufax, and often Don Drysdale pitched while he was in school. So he was he was born to be a Dodger, and yet he's a Met. So it comes down first to 1965. He gets drafted by the Dodgers, and Tom Lasorda shows up at his house and says, "I'll get $2,000 for you." And Seaver said, "I want $50,000." And Lasorda said, "Good luck with your dental career," because he was a pre-dental student. So he went back to USC, and another draft comes around, this time in January of 1966, and this time the Milwaukee Braves, who are in the process of going to Atlanta, draft him. And they recognize his ability and offer him that $50,000 that he said he wanted. And he decides to sign. However, the college season had started, because USC plays in warm weather, and they'd played a game in January, I think against the Camp Pendleton Marines, which oddly had been Seaver's team a couple of years earlier. He'd been in the Marines. And so Rod Dato, the coach, told the Major League Baseball, he can't sign. He's already started his college season. It's against the rules, and they agreed. Seaver says, well, that's okay. I'll go back to USC, pitch the season, probably get more in the June draft. The NCAA then says, no, as far as we're concerned, in our eyes, you are a professional. Now he can't pitch for USC or for the Braves. So he's stuck. His dad writes a letter to the commissioner of baseball who says, I got a solution. Anybody who's willing to match the Braves' $50,000 or $51,500 offer, I think, can enter a draw or a lottery. Three teams, the Mets, Philadelphia Phillies, and Cleveland Indians, enter this lottery. The Los Angeles Dodgers wants to enter the lottery. Buzzy Bavezzi, however, is in the middle of intense negotiations with Don Drysdale and Sandy Koufax, who have a team. How would you call it? They're in holdout. They're holding out for greater salary together, in unison, like a union. So Bavezzi forgets to get the Dodgers' name in. So the draft is held, and the Dodgers for the second time blow it. And the Mets have their first lucky break, and they are selected. And that's how he ends up being a New York Met. And then flash forward another 11 years, 1977. There was a big trade possibility. This is when the Mets are going to trade Seaver. It's a done deal, and it's going to be Tom Seaver to the Dodgers for Don Sutton, which would have been a great trade for the Dodgers. But somehow that trade doesn't happen. He ends up with Cincinnati. So. But in terms of the New York Mets, you know, they had him 11 years, and it made their franchise.
Yes, it did. And you know what? L.A.'s loss was New York's gain, as far as I'm concerned. Now, let's move forward to 1969. Seaver has already basically established himself as one of the best pitchers in baseball at that time even. Why was 1969 so special for the New York Mets?
I really don't think there's ever been a season like it in sports history. You can go back and you can study sports history. You can study, for instance, the 1980 Miracle on Ice. You can study, I don't even know how many things to even compare it to. You know, the 1914 Boston Braves, for people who really know baseball. I don't even know where to go. This is the most improbable sports victory, the most improbable event that ever happened. And, you know, there was a movie called Oh God, starred George Burns. And John Denver is talking to George Burns, who plays God, and says, well, you know, what was your last miracle? I mean, you know, tell me, but, you know, was it the Red Sea, or, you know, was it, you know, what was it? He says, oh, well, I don't dabble in too many miracles, but my last one was the 69 Mets. And, you know, that's what it was like. I look at that season almost the way Israel won the 67 and 1973 wars. If you've ever studied those wars, it's difficult to conceive that God did not favor them. There were miracles that occurred on battlefields, and there were miracles that occurred on the field of play in 19. Every single thing that could have happened right happened in serendipitous fashion, and it made Gil Hodges look like an absolute prophet and genius above and beyond what he really was. And, you know, they end up beating the Orioles in the World Series. Now, you know, okay, they win the World Series. They're an underdog team. This isn't just a regular team. This is a team that won 109 games and might have been the greatest baseball team ever assembled. And there's no way you're going to beat Baltimore. And then Seaver loses the first game, and they still win the next four. And they won all of their major championships, Division League and World Series, at home in front of adoring fans in atmospheres that are like Pentecostal revivals. And getting back to the age of innocence, you know, New York sports fans have become pretty rough. And in 1976, for instance, when the Yankees beat the Royals, there was a rush on the field that was almost dangerous, with Reggie Jackson running off the field almost for his life. And you look at the fans Even when they ran on the field in 69, it wasn't like that. It was joyous. It was like the saved entering the kingdom of heaven. So I know I use a lot of religious references, but I couldn't help myself. That's what it seemed like. It was a miracle what happened to those guys. So that was 1969.
That's right. And if folks, if you want to read more about that, Stephen's written a book about the 1969 Mets, and you'll be able to get that book through my website through the link that I leave to this book. 1977 was, I'll never forget it, because I cried for 2 days when New York traded Tom Seaver, Tom Terrific, my hero, to the Cincinnati Reds. What was that all about briefly, Stephen?
Well, it was about money, and it was about jealousy. It was about free agency. You know, it was all the ugly things that had entered sports. Seaver had signed a contract, and then free agency really hit full bloom, and Reggie Jackson suddenly was a Yankee and was making more money than any player, any athlete had even dreamt of making. And here's Tom Seaver, every bit as good an athlete as Reggie Jackson, not being paid, you know, one-tenth of what Jackson was being paid. And he said, well, you know, I want to renegotiate. And he was willing to do it in good faith, and he wasn't making any real he wasn't making demands or threatening to walk. He just said, I want you guys to think, you know, renegotiate in good faith with me. And here's a guy who went to USC. It was a very conservative school, served in the Marines, was a moderate Ford Republican, and could be, you know, is a pretty decent American citizen. And the owner of the Mets called him a communist just for asking to be renegotiating his contract. And then got on a big thing that Seaver shouldn't even be at the Greenwich Country Club because it was supposedly below his station. Very strange event. And then the columnist Dick Young, I guess he was with the New York Post at the time, starts writing these vitriolic columns, really blaming everything on Seaver, and then finally drags his wife into it. And Seaver said, I don't like this. I don't want to be part of this. I want to be traded. And he was.
Yeah, that was awful. And the Dick Young thing, I do remember. It was not pleasant. You know, whether you intended to or not, you made a strong case for Seaver being the greatest pitcher of all time. What are your feelings about that now, Stephen, that you've completed the book, you've had some time to reflect on what you've written? How do you feel about Tom Seaver being the greatest pitcher of all time?
I would do not disagree that he might just be. Now, you know, who is the greatest pitcher of all time? This is a barroom argument, you know, probably requires a few beers and, you know, more time than we have. But, you know, who is it? Is it Walter Johnson? Is it Bob Feller? Is it Sandy Koufax? Is it Roger Clemens? Well, you can make an argument for any of those guys. I do believe that the steroid era has changed the perception of Seaver, because there are a few guys who passed Seaver statistically after he left who I think got involved in steroids. And so, therefore, I'm going to look at their record the same way I'm going to downgrade Barry Bonds a little bit and upgrade Hank Aaron. So, you look at the old timers. Well, okay, Walter Johnson, Christy Mathewson, great. But that's, you know, that's what's called the dead ball era. You couldn't hit the ball out of the ballpark. The statistics for pitchers at that time were ridiculous. You can't make those comparisons. You can't. You know, if a guy goes 31-4 with a 1.7 ERA in 1912, to me, that's, you know, the same as going 22-5 with a 2.1 ERA in the modern era. It's about the same, if not less. So then you get down to longevity. Bob Feller, you know, sure, he might have been the greatest, but he missed 4 years in World War II, and it has to be factored in. Sandy Koufax was probably the greatest pitcher for about 5 years, but it's only 5 years. Seaver was great for 15, 20 years. And if you look at Seaver from his five dominant seasons, let's call it 1969 to 1973, 68 to 73. He's as dominant as Koufax. His ERAs, his strikeouts, it's close. And then he had a longer career than Koufax, and he achieved far greater things in terms of his lifetime records. And I count those lifetime records as being very important. So in that regard, he's right up there. I don't know if he's the greatest, but he's in that short discussion. He's in there. He's in that top five, and he should be.
Yes, he should. And I have to hide my prejudice here because I thought he was the best ever. I still do, and I think your book actually proves it, at least in my opinion. And that's okay. That's what the book is about, to make form our own opinions, and you did a fantastic job with that. You know, one of the things that you mentioned in the book was that Seaver wanted a job in broadcasting, and then he did broadcast for the Mets and for the Yankees, right? And why isn't he still broadcasting? Because he's still relatively a young guy, right?
Well, I don't really know why he no longer does it. I think it gets to the question of achieving all you can do in life. And you know, he's a native Californian, and he was, but he made his name in New York City amidst the hustle and the bustle of New York and Greenwich, Connecticut, and all of that means, you know, living in Greenwich, Connecticut is a statement. It's a social and political statement. And he lived that life, and he did it all, and he did it in the biggest stage that there can be. And he made a statement a few years ago. He now grows wine in the Napa wine country, and he's taken a lot of pride in it. But he says, I don't need to be on the cover of Wine Spectator magazine, and which is obviously not as big as Sports Illustrated, but the point is, he doesn't need it anymore. He doesn't need to be on the cover of anybody's magazine. He's done it. Everything that he could achieve, he's done. So I think he's happy. You know, he's obviously happy just to live with his lovely wife, Nancy, in a beautiful place. I mean, it's like paradise where he is, and grow grapes. And he invites a lot of old friends and family and old baseball friends up there. And I bet that's a lot of fun to have some guys like Don Baylor and Bill Spaceman Lee and, you know, and Nolan Ryan come out there and drink a little wine, and listen to some music, probably Sinatra, you know, and reminisce. And I tell you, you know, there's a lot to be said for that. So this is a content fellow. He's a content fellow. And he did it the right way, and that's why.
Yeah, I have to agree. I think so. You know, we're here with Mr. Stephen Travers, author, talking about his latest book, The Last Icon, Tom Seaver and His Times. I ask this question of every author that comes on the program, and I always let you know I'm going to do it. But give us three reasons why we should buy this book.
Well, first of all, if you are a Tom Seaver fan, you are going to learn just about everything you need to know about him. Second, and I think you alluded to this in terms of my analysis of his place in baseball history, this is something that needed to be done, that this argument needed to be made, and I took I used statistics, and I used logic, and I used facts, not just emotion, and not just the fact that I, like you, am a Tom Seaver fan, but, you know, made comparisons of his records, his statistics, his earned run average, and made the argument that, hey, this guy might be the greatest pitcher that ever lived. And then I think there's more than three reasons, but I think another one also is, you know, New York City. And, you know, you're from back east. There is a charisma to that city. There is a Sinatra swank. You know, there's something nostalgic. 60s. And what it represented and what this sports team represented to that city puts it back in time. The city had fallen after, you know, it was the great city. It was the new Rome. This was Rome after Caesar takes Gaul. And they fell by the wayside in the late 60s. And Los Angeles took over as the great American city, the city of the future. New York was roiled in racial and economic and union strife. And here comes not just the Mets, but the Jets, the Mets, and the Knicks, all reviving this town with sports excellence. And it really played a big role in helping that city get back on its feet. Ray Robinson called it the brutally beaten but unbowed city of New York. So for New Yorkers, I think there's a third reason to read this book, because it'll give you either a nostalgic look back if you remember the times, or a good history lesson.
And I'm going to give you a fourth reason, Mets fans, all of you listening. Phil Nason's actually purchased this book with his own money. And I didn't, as usual, I get free copies, but not this time. I purchased this book because I'm a Tom Seaver fan. I was not let down, and neither will any of you who take the time to put a few pennies together to buy this book. There'll be links to the Amazon page where you can purchase this book. It will also be, those will be accompanied by my review of this book, as well as this audio. I really want to see this book succeed, because to me it captured everything about that time period. For me, 71, 72, 75, 77, and so forth. But for you folks who don't remember those times, Steve is going to take you back there. And I promise you, it was real. I couldn't contest anything that he has written in this book, and I don't think anyone else can either. Okay, last thing, Stephen, what's next for you?
Well, I am currently writing a book which is really on movements, communications, and the media. And it's based upon a projected class that I might be teaching at the University of Southern California. So that's a very exciting project for me.
Terrific. Stephen, thank you so much for coming on the program. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much for having me and giving me an opportunity to talk about something that is very near and dear, obviously, to both of our hearts.
Yeah, it was. And I'll leave links to the book as well as the review that I've written about this book in the show notes. And the fun doesn't stop here, folks. Coming up next, I'll be joined by my good friend and Colorado Rockies fan, Ruben Mills, to talk all about last weekend's Mets-Rockies series. You're listening to The Phil Nason Show. All right, we're back at the Phil Nason Show. And I'll tell you what, I've been looking forward to this for like a week. This past weekend, the New York Mets and the Colorado Rockies played a three-game series. And on the line to discuss this with me is my friend, Mr. Ruben Mills. He's also a Colorado Rockies fanatic. Ruben, welcome to the Phil Nason Show, my friend. How you doing?
Excellent. Yeah, definitely a complete fanatic for the Colorado Rockies. And bummed that you took us in that series, but oh well, we'll get you next time.
Okay, that's a good attitude to have, because after the first game, you know, when I woke up Saturday morning, and it was still Friday night for you, and I saw that score 18-9, I said, oh, the Denver Broncos and the New York Jets were playing a preseason game. Let me ask you something, though, because you see all the games in Colorado and have for years. Is that normal to have that many runs scored in a game?
Well, 11 runs in one inning, no. I've been trying to remember when the last time was I ever saw anything like that. That's not real typical. I mean, the Rockies have been doing really good in the later innings this year, picking up the runs, not so good in the early innings. But I tell you, Phil, that's a game that I don't think I'm ever going to be able to forget. That was phenomenal.
It was huge. I didn't see any of those games because they're on the West Coast and I'm either doing my show or what have you. But, Todd Helton, you know, he's still plugging away. And I remember the last time that you came on this program, you couldn't praise him enough. How's he doing this year?
He's doing good. I mean, he's floating around 230 average right now. But, you know, when he came in and pinch hit that grand slam, that's just one of those moments where you remember the reason why you love Todd Helton, and you knew as soon as he hit that thing and kind of rolled the bat back off of his shoulder that this was real and that he had done it again. They've been slowing him down a little bit, giving him days off here and there. I'm not quite sure how many games he's been at, but most of them, I'm thinking he's taking about one off a week. Looking at my stats page here because I'm cheating, he's up to 4 home runs. And the beginning of the season was looking incredible with Todd Helton because he's just been doing tremendous with RBIs. So while he hasn't been producing, you know, these epic showstoppers that get the video clip on ESPN, he's definitely been producing some runs for us, just chipping away and getting balls out to the outfield to get a couple of guys across the base, and he's still going strong. I kind of get disappointed when people are thinking, man, that guy's getting up there in years, and when are you going to think about putting him aside for some young rocket ship arm? Not really interested in that. He's still doing a phenomenal job, and I think we're going to see a lot more out of Todd Helton this year and look back over the course of the year and realize that without guys like this, we'd pretty well be skunked. He's still the best first base guy we've ever had, and I love him.
Yeah, that's, you should. You know, the thing is, we talked about these grand slams, but Hernandez hit a grand slam, right? The bottom of the 7th?
Yeah.
You know, and that game was crazy because in that same game, and something that's you don't see a lot, is Scott Hairston hit for the cycle.
Yeah.
I mean, that was a lot of crazy stuff going on, excuse me, in that game. Well, you're watching this thing, and you're watching this, and you're laughing because you can't wait to dig into me. And that's fair enough because a lot of people love to give it to me when they beat the Mets, and that's fair enough. But you're watching this thing and all these runs. I mean, how many, geez, how many times did you just go, wow, in that game?
I sat there in disbelief for quite a while. The thing that was cracking me up was the announcers on Root Sports. They were just flabbergasted. They were really finding it difficult to articulate what it was that they were watching and basically just explaining, sorry, we don't have words. We haven't seen anything like this before. I mean, the last time that these guys were speechless was in a game that went something like, I don't know what it was, 21, 22 innings before the game finally broke. And I think that at that point, they were just sick of it and didn't want to say anything else. But everybody was at a loss. And frankly, I kind of got to a point there where I was feeling bad for the Mets. Like, has the bullpen just completely imploded in this game? Is there absolutely when does the manager walk out to the mound and put a bullet through the guy's head and put everybody out of their misery? It was just, it was kind of painful and hilarious to watch all at the same time. Yeah, I've certainly never seen anything that crazy before. But again, that game sort of underscored some of the problems that the Rockies have been having. You probably saw a little bit of it in that series. We haven't got any starting pitchers that are making it much beyond 5 innings, and then we're going crazy to get our bullpen spooled up to save the day. And that game really kind of underscored bad pitching on both sides. I mean, you guys still got 9 runs in. And that was due an awful lot to some of our real lousy pitching. What do you think?
I think we're in the same boat because our bullpen has pitched ridiculous. And the thing is, or they pitched good at times, but this last week, especially against Houston, ugh, it's been a nightmare to even think about. But, you know, we have similar situations in New York because at times our starting pitchers don't go very far. The last one that did was Mike Pelfrey against the Florida Marlins. Or no, it wasn't against the Florida Marlins. Who was, it doesn't matter, I guess. And now he's done for the season with Tommy John surgery. He went 8 innings.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so we've had the same thing. You know, but we've had some decent outings from our starting staff. Johan Santana, he's pitched really well except for one night, and he's has not gotten a decision yet. He's gotten a loss but not a win. He threw a two-hitter the other night, and the Mets still lost. I mean, yeah, because the bullpen didn't get it done. Manny Acosta came in and just blew it up. And like you said, you were right. You know, when you watch the Mets, especially that game, you're like, yeah, I would feel sorry for my team too because our bullpen is really awful, you know, at times. And at other times it's okay, but if something has to be done for both of us or else this is going to be a miserable year for both of us, Ruben.
Yeah, absolutely. When Jim Tracy, the manager of the ball team, is getting in front of the press after a bad game and saying, look, folks, I'm sorry, but defensively we're just not hacking it. And we'll get a good guy out there like Jamie Moyer who will pitch just a phenomenal game and show these kids what pitching baseball is all about. And we've got Troy Tulowitzki committing error after error. Bobbling, but balls rolling right between his legs. Just the craziest stuff that you've ever seen. Guys standing in the outfield looking at the sky wondering where the ball is. This is Little League stuff. Okay? So we may have the hottest bats in the entire universe, but definitely, I think everybody in Colorado has sort of acknowledged that defensively we've really got to tighten things up. And, Hoping that it happens soon because we're heading into some serious difficult road games and I want to see this team stay over 500.
Well, I think they've done pretty well to do that with this series with Los Angeles, haven't they? Because we have mutual friends that love the Dodgers.
Yeah,
they're probably not too happy right now, are they?
No, Jason Giambi, another one of the older guys, a veteran of the game, came in and we had guys on the corner, Todd Helton at first base, Troy Tulowitzki at third. And this was, again, one of those absolutely beautiful moments. It's the bottom of the ninth inning. And they're trying to make Giambi the third out. And the game is 5-5, and Giambi just nails one clear back into the Rockies' bullpen and walk-off three-run homer. Absolutely beautiful. I'm sure that, and that was two of three games against the LA Dodgers, and right now the Dodgers are at the head of the National League West. So I'm pretty proud of today's game. Definitely do want to mention our mutual friends who are Dodgers fans that we killed you, and we'll see you the next time you're here.
Yeah, that's a tall order these days to take out the Dodgers, and I'm sure our mutual friends are going to be thrilled to hear you say what you just said. But I tell you something. This was a woolly series with you guys. It usually is, though. But on Saturday night, what did you have? You had Tulowitzki. He did okay. Helton did all right. But Dexter Fowler, now he hit his fourth home run of the season that night off Frank Francisco, our closer. And it got dicey, too, even though the Mets won. That, again, goes back to that bullpen. But Dexter Fowler, now he's a guy you mentioned on this show last month. Has he lived? He's fulfilled, lived up to what you said, hasn't he?
Yeah, he's doing phenomenal. I'm watching Dexter Fowler specifically when he's at bat. I'll pay real close attention. He's following pitches better. He's letting balls go by easier. He's not getting quite as anxious. His four runs so far this season, I'm sure, is something that most people weren't expecting at all. Right now, I think he's at 11 RBIs. So he's been really useful to the baseball team. I'm kind of surprised that he hasn't stolen more bases. I mean, he's incredibly fast. He's a real stringy guy, and he can just move. He has got wheels. So I'm still really excited about Dexter Fowler. I'm kind of wondering if anybody stuck him on their fantasy team and are pleased with how he's working out so far. I think he's at 240 or so, but I tell you, I'm just in love with the guy. I think it was two baseball games ago, a Dodgers game, they gave out 20,000 free Dexter Fowler t-shirts, and people were literally showing up to the game hour and a half, 2 hours early so that they could be in line to be one of the 20,000 to get his free t-shirt. So he's still becoming quite the phenomenon in Colorado. I'm super excited about Fowler.
I'll tell you another thing. And then Sunday, okay, now we're 1-1. And then Sunday, you have Jamie Moyer against Johan Santana. Now, this is another night where Santana throws a two-hitter over six innings. Strikes out five, walks three, though, and doesn't get the decision. And Moyer gave up 11 hits, four runs, four earned runs, whatever. What's it like to watch that guy pitch, Jamie Moyer, 49 years old, Ruben, and he's still getting it done at the major league level? What is that? What kind of inspiration is he?
We get an awful lot of extra coverage on Moyer here, obviously, because the local media will follow him around and do interviews with him. He's such a stand-up guy. First of all, it blows me away that the guy will actually tip his hat to the home plate umpire after he's pitched a game. Like, who does that? That's not even something that you see or hear about ever. But the games that he pitches well, and he's still out pitching as far as pitch count and inning count, pretty much anybody that we've got on our team right now. What he does is amazing, and maybe I didn't really understand Moyer prior to him coming to Colorado, but it seems that everybody has always been sort of amazed at how he can follow no pattern whatsoever. You go to bat against Jamie Moyer and you're facing chaos because you have no idea what's going to come next. And even though he's not pitching 95-mile-an-hour balls, guys get incredibly frustrated watching these pitches go right over the plate, and they have no idea where it came from. The thing that really blows me away about watching him pitch is how relaxed he is and how balanced he is, even at 49 years old. And when he had won the game that put him in the record books as the oldest pitcher in Major League history to win a game, you could see that there were 20-something guys out there just in absolute shock and awe, and not thinking this is some sort of a comical whatever. I don't know what the Rockies were thinking, but genuinely blown away at the performance that this guy can bring to the mound. Now, he had to earn his position on the Rockies baseball team, and I think he did. And I'm really hoping that he can just bring that consistent chaos, for lack of a better term, and relaxation to the mound, and really just sort of try to bring some sort of a balance to our bullpen. I'm really hoping that he'll teach some of these younger guys what's up too.
Well, he can't hurt. You know, he's not doing too bad this year, really. He's well under his career ERA, and he's 1-2, 16 strikeouts. That's not too shabby for a guy his age. For a guy half his age. There are guys half his age that can't get to that statistics or those statistics. So what can you do? But that Sunday game, 6-5 in 11 innings, how do you react when you see these long, drawn-out, extra-inning games? Do you get stressed when you watch these games, or do you just sit back and go, oh, well, it's cool, you know what, I get to see more baseball? How does it affect you, these extra-inning games?
Well, I grew up in a football family that was just completely crazy at the television about football, and I guess it sort of rubbed off on me. When we start going extra innings, I really start getting stressed. It's not a very exciting thing for me because I'm engrossed in a game and looking at every moving part and trying to figure out what Apodaca is thinking up and who they're spooling up in the bullpen and watching Jim Tracy pace back and forth in the dugout and scratch his head and scratch his chin and write stuff in the notebook and it really kind of stresses me out. And my wife would probably be the one better to answer that question, but I get a little bit overly dramatic and yell at the TV quite a bit and give pitchers and batters and umpires a piece of my mind as if they can hear me across the television set. it's a pretty stressful ordeal for me, but at the end of the day, I still love it. And I think if I didn't love it so much, I wouldn't get so completely stressed out over those super tight, long, drawn-out battles. But to say that I don't enjoy it, that just wouldn't be the case. I love getting stressed out over baseball games, as I'm sure you do. Or maybe you don't.
I don't get stressed out because I've been in sports for a while. But what it is for me is I always like a time factor, especially when I'm watching a game live on the stream, on an internet stream. I'm always wondering how long my luck will hold out before the stream goes down. And it always goes down like in the eighth inning or the ninth inning. So I try. That probably stresses me out more than the actual game. But I enjoy the game, you know, especially close games. If I were a Colorado Rockies fan on Sunday, I would have jumped out of my chair after Helton hit that pinch hit grand slam.
Yep.
And that's what you did. And you were going, I got him. We got him. I cannot wait to see Phil's reaction on Sunday night. Because we're going to get him. And it didn't happen.
Yeah.
And that's unfortunate, but it was a great series. I mean, a lot of runs scored. And is it because it's in Denver and it's just a mile high thing and the air is lighter? Is that what it is?
It could very well be. I don't know. Rockies fans are all fanatics. It's pretty much the same with any of our teams. Of course, right now, everybody in Colorado is stressing and cheering the Denver Nuggets and I pay so little attention to basketball that I don't really know what's going on, but I guess they made 7th seed in the playoffs or something like that.
Yeah, that's right.
Of course, with Peyton Manning in town, it's completely changed the dynamics of everything football related. And now people are wishing that they could be cryogenically frozen and reanimated when football season starts.
Right, of course. Yeah, because that's a big ticket now, Peyton Manning. But I'll tell you what, the Rockies still have their fan support. And yeah, the Nuggets have done okay, but the Nuggets are going out now. So you have the Rockies now for another 2 months before football starts. But it's big still there, right? Baseball's still big in Colorado, correct?
Oh, absolutely. Today was a day game that, on a on a Wednesday, like, who's going to be able to go to that baseball game? There were just over 30,000 people in the stadium. It's kind of a mind blower. I think the fan base and the fan loyalty in Colorado is probably rivals almost anywhere else in the country. I don't know about the city of brotherly love. They might have the upper hand on things like that. But we love our team.
And you should. Why not? You know, how are they treating Tulowitzki right now? Because he's not actually doing what he usually does, at least at the plate, and he's throwing the ball away a lot. What's up with that? And how are they treating him? Have the fans turned their back on Troy Tulowitzki yet?
No, nobody really has. I mean, there's kind of an interesting fan dynamic that I'm sure happens everywhere. When you see Troy kind of getting ahead of himself and really trying to overhit and overthrow because he's stressed in the game or whatever is going on, you don't typically see fans, you know, grabbing pitchforks and torches and running after Troy Tulowitzki. You typically hear him calling up the radio shows and saying, where are we going to fire the batting coach? And that kind of thing just really kind of makes me scratch my head. I think that Troy is perfectly capable of batting if he can keep his head about himself, and all of this talk of when are we going to fire that coach and when are we going to run that guy out of town really kind of confuses me. I think when you're dealing with Major League Baseball players who are getting paid the amount of money that these Major League Baseball players are making, they're going to have a coach come up to them and say, here's what you need to do to fix this, and here's where your head needs to be in that type of a situation. And I'm relatively certain that 80-90% of those guys in Major League Baseball are going to be like, yeah, right, whatever. I'm going to do my thing because it's what's made me famous, and it's why I get paid the money I get paid. I think that when you get to the Major League level, pitching coaches and batting coaches are sort of a necessary evil in the game, and I'm not entirely certain that they have the degree of influence or impact on these players that people think they do. So it kind of bothers me a little bit that when you see somebody like Troy Tulowitzki lagging in his season, that everybody starts saying, well, when are we going to fire the batting coach? I don't think that has very much to do with it at all. I think Troy just needs to get his head in the game a little bit better and level out when things are not going his way and just stick to what he is good at and not try to be the hero that saves the day, overbat, overthrow. Does that sort of make sense?
Yeah, sure it does. You know, we have the same issue in New York with Ike Davis, our first baseman. You know, he missed most of the season last year with a freak injury that was misdiagnosed. And this year, apparently, he caught some valley fever or something that's similar to mono. And he hasn't gotten on track yet either. The fans are still supporting him right now, but we'll see how that goes. But you know what, with his batting coaches and pitching coaches, I agree with you. When you get to the top level, it's more of a mental thing, really. It's, you know, but people like to blame the coach. I know I'm a coach, and I know it's not fun sometimes. I'll tell you what, you guys got an interesting series coming up with Atlanta this weekend.
Yeah, I'm a little bit spooked about it.
Okay.
But we'll see how it works out. I'm not sure where take a look here. Atlanta's at 14-10 right now. And from what I've heard, playing really well. Hey, I tell you, the last time that we had talked, I had to admit that I had only been to two baseball games in my life. The third one is coming up on the 19th. Another mutual friend of ours,
He's a Seattle Mariners fan, right? You talking about Ryan?
Seattle Mariners fan.
You talking about Ryan? Yeah, sure.
Talking about Ryan, we're gonna pile up the families and go to the ballpark and if you happen to catch that game online and you see two guys beating the crap out of each other at that game, that'd probably be Ryan and I.
I bet you some of our friends in the online world would love to see that. Pastor attacks his one of his members. That would be interesting. But gosh, you know what? It's been a great time with you, my friend.
Absolutely, Phil. It's always fun.
And I didn't rub it in once, did I?
No, and I hope I didn't too much either.
No, that's okay, because you didn't really have a lot to rub in, because you did lose 2 out of 3. But it's all good, my friend. It's all good. It's all good. And that's going to wrap it up for this edition of the Phil Nason Show. Special thanks to all of my guests for making this a very enjoyable program. If you like what you hear, I'd like to invite you to follow me on Twitter at FlashTennis31. And you can listen to this show Monday and Thursday afternoons at 3 p.m. on Fat Sports Radio. And if you want to bring the Phil Nason Show to your radio station or internet station or whatever, you can contact me at PNAESSENSSHOW@gmail.com and we'll get you started on bringing the show to you. Tomorrow night I'll be talking NBA hoops with Ben Parker and Jamie and Smith. And following that up, we'll be previewing the Floyd Mayweather Jr. Miguel Cotto fight with boxing expert Scoop Malinowski. Until then, please take care of yourselves. And thanks for listening. Good night.